The 100 Years' War, the Gisclun period, English finances in 1380, and probably into 81. By the end of 1380, England's financial and military resources were more tightly stretched than they had been at any time in the past 40 years. In addition to the 5,000 English troops serving under the Earl of Buckingham in France, there were about 2,000 men distributed between the garrisons of Calais, Cherbourg, and Brest, with another 1,000 in Gascony, making a total of 8,000 men serving in France. The council was also having to meet growing demands for troops at home. A deteriorating situation in Ireland had made it necessary to send Edmund Mortimer, the Earl of March, there with 1,000 men, the largest English garrison force to serve on the island in many years. A far graver threat, because it was closer to home, had erupted in the Scottish March. In reprisal for the loss of two of their merchant ships at sea, the Scots captured Ralph Lord Greystoke and his entire retinue of 120 men in the Glen Valley south of the border as he was on his way to take up his duties as captain of the Roxburgh Castle. The hall also included a great quantity of tapestries and plate with which Greystoke intended to decorate his austere quarters. This incident was followed by a large-scale Scottish raid in the Cumberland led by the Earl of Douglas, which resulted in almost total destruction of Perinth and a retaliatory raid by the English wardens in the western lowlands. Faced with the prospect of a breakdown in the truce in the Scottish March, Richard II's council decided to take the affairs out of the hands of the border lords. In September, they appointed John of Gaunt as the royal lieutenant on the march and sent him hurriedly to the north as many troops as could be found. By the end of October, there were some 3,000 men serving on the Scottish march in addition to the locally recruited hordes of Percys and Cliffords. This brought the total number of troops maintained in arms by the English government to 12,000, divided between four fronts. An exceptionally high proportion of the tiny section of the population with skills and aptitudes to fight as men of arms or archers. It was the most difficult possible moment to have to meet further demands from lieutenants and allies. Yet the government was now committed to sending another 2,000 men to reinforce Buckingham in Brittany and at least 2,000 more to Portugal in the following spring. Encouraged perhaps by reports of the troubles of France, the English government had assumed some exceptionally heavy financial commitments. The cost of the Earl of Buckingham's campaign had been grossly underestimated. About £76,000 had already been spent on that expedition up till September of 1380. It included shipping costs. If it lasted the full year envisioned by the men's indentures, the final bill would be twice as much, even without the promised reinforcements. In addition, about £40,000 had to be paid out to claims for soldiers and seamen's wages accumulated from past campaigns, dating back to the beginning of the reign, and in some cases even earlier. The rest of the government's military commitments brought the total to about £280,000. This figure is roughly comparable to the annual war budget of France. It was more than England had to spend in any comparable period since the campaigns in the Low Countries, which had bankrupted Edward III in the early years of the war. To meet it, the government had revenues available for war expenditures amounting to about £100,000. A combination of high overheads, overambition, and lack of candor in the dealings with the Commons had put Richard's council in an impossible position. The parliamentary subsidy by March of 1380 had represented a substantial commitment by the Commons, at the express understanding that there would be asked for no further funds until the minimum of autumn of 1381. In August of 1380, less than a month after Buckingham had marched out of Calais, the council was obliged to summons a new parliament for early November, a fall due in December. The pay of the king's garrisons in France, Scotland, and Ireland had fallen in arrears, and some of the men were threatening to desert. The coasts were defenseless. The king's creditors were demanding repayment. Some of them had liens over the king's few remaining jewels and were threatening to sell them. A further large grant, said Sudbury, was unavoidable. The loyal Sir John Gildesberg, who was once again elected speaker, came before the lords and asked the king's counselors for a precise statement of the government's financial needs. needs. The commons, he said, wanted a figure in which they could have confidence, not something that would simply serve as a prelude for further demands later. He was given a copy of a schedule prepared by the king's financial officers. It showed that there was a deficiency in the government war accounts of £160,000. This figure broadly accords with the surviving financial records. The commons was stunned. The government's demands were outrageous and insupportable, they said. They represented between 2 and 3 years' worth of war subsidies at the customary rate. The commons insisted that the figure should be reduced and invited the lords to consider how this could be done. They seem to have expected the lords to consider what military expenditures could be dispensed with. In fact, the peers responded with alternative proposals for raising the whole sum. One was the traditional 10th and 15th on movable property. At least 3/10 and 15ths would have been required. This was, as always, profoundly unpopular with the interest represented in the commons because of the anomalies associated with the antique assessment of 1334. The second possibility was a general sales tax after the model of the French aids, which would have fallen disproportionately on the towns and required the creation of a new and expensive fiscal administration. The third was a graduated poll tax assessed at each community at a flat rate of 4 or 5 groats, 1 shilling 4d or 1 shilling 8d per head in the household, but distributed amongst individuals according to the ability to pay. After much deliberation, commons decided on the poll tax. At the beginning of December 1380, they resolved upon a grant of 100,000 marks, £66,666. They proposed that the clergy should contribute half as much again, making the total £100,000. The poll tax of 1377 had been levied at an average rate of 4 pence a head and had produced a total assessment of £22,586. So the commons simply trebled the rate and imposed an average payment of 12 pence a head. At the same time, they withdrew the expensive concessions, which had reduced the yield of the tax of 1379. The age of eligibility was reduced from 16 to 15, and the exemption for married women was abolished. The result was a highly regressive tax, born of the commons' conviction that traditional taxes let wage earners off too lightly at a time of strong wage inflation. All the money of the realm had passed through the hands of laborers and craftsmen, as they complained 2 years earlier. The commons at Northampton declared that within every community, the strong should aid the weak. There was no graded table of contributions, as there had been in 1379, and no other mechanism for requiring the rich to pay more. In the poorest community, there was simply not enough rich taxpayers to carry their neighbor's burden. The size of the grant made by the Northampton Parliament, coming so soon after the generous grant made earlier in the year, was a measure of commitment which English political community still felt to the war. If the grant fell well short of what the government had asked for, still represented the maximum that the commons thought the taxpayer could beat. The proceeds were to be strictly reserved for the Earl of Buckingham's army in France, for the defense of England, and for operations at sea. The commons at Northampton were no more interested in England's continental barbicans than their predecessors had been, and presumably did not regard the expedition of Portugal as being in anyone's interest but John of Gaunt's. The clergy were pressured into making their own grants more promptly and generously than had been their habit. The Convocation of Canterbury met at the parish church of All Saints, Northampton, immediately after the dissolution of Parliament, to raise £33,334,000. It's expected of them they had to authorize a poll tax at an even higher rate than those payable by the laity, 6 shillings 8p for every monk, nun, or priest in the land, with a reduced rate of 1 shilling for those in deacons or other lesser roles. Thus was born one of the most hated and destructive taxes in English history, whose very name could be invoked to discredit other capitation taxes more than 6 centuries later. So we'll pick up there next time, see how it works and how it all comes about with England. Now the sources for this: The Hundred Years' War, The Chronicles by Froissart, The Hundred Years' War by Perrois, The Hundred Years' War by Nylans, and The Hundred Years' War, The House Divided, Volume 3 by Sumption. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.